You're listening to the Seth Adam Podcast.
You can tell who the real ones are. They won't let you down. You can tell who the real ones are. They won't let you down.
Hey, everybody. How you doing? Seth Adam here. Welcome to the Seth Adam Podcast, Episode 4. This week we have Brian Dolzani. I was really psyched about doing this interview. He's just a tremendous songwriter, sweetheart guy, really, really kind soul. If you have a chance, no, not if you have a chance, just go do it. Check out his music. He's everywhere, and you could go to his website at briandolzani.com. I have some things going on this week, at per usual, but this week is going to be different. I'm actually going to be going out on the road for 3 dates with a relatively new group called Sister Willow. Be playing bass with them. We're going to be in Allentown on Thursday, May 2nd at Miller Symphony Hall. On Friday, May 3rd, we're going to be at Don't Tell Mama in New York City. And on Saturday, May 4th, we'll be at the State House in New Haven, Connecticut. That's sisterwillow.com. Abigail Zyga, Chrissy Gardner, and Megan Cheneau. I'm playing bass with them. Should be a fun week, and it'll get my vocal cords a rest. And now, without any further ado, it gives me great pleasure to give you this interview, Mr. Brian Dolzani. We are here. We are now. We are here with the mighty, excellent, awesome Brian Dolzani. Brian Dolzani,
hey,
from
folks.
Connecticut.
Hey.
Yeah.
Thanks
Singer,
so much.
Singer-songwriter extraordinaire. We got a lot to talk about today with you.
Right on.
So I hope you have a lot of oxygen.
Yeah.
I like to start the podcast with a thing called full disclosure. So full disclosure, and this one is more of like a full disclosure to the best of my knowledge, that I've known about you for years and years, but I don't think we actually met until you played a Stella Blues open mic night that I was hosting probably in 2009, 2010, around there.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, for sure.
Because I was racking my brain and I'm like, I can't remember when or where the exact time and date that we met was, but
yeah.
But I like to be truthful in my reporting.
Yeah. So like a real journalist.
Yeah. Except I don't have that fancy degree.
Right.
I mean, we're literally doing a podcast in a basement. I don't, you know. We're going to talk about you. Where'd you come from? Where'd you grow up? I know that you're from Fairfield.
Yeah,
right
yeah.
Now.
So, yep, born,
is that where you're from?
Yeah, born and raised here. And
you're a Connecticut boy.
Yeah, Connecticut native. And yeah, so I let's see. Yeah, I went through. You know, so it's kind of funny. Last night, I went to nursery school in Fairfield, St. Paul's Nursery School, when I was 3 years old, 4 years old, and they just had their 50th anniversary party last night, gala. At the Fairfield Museum, celebrating their, this nursery school. It opened up in 69, and I went there in, I'll put some dates on me, I suppose, in the mid-70s. And and so I played a few songs last night at their gala, which was really cool. So that's kind of a little Fairfield tie-in.
A little full circle.
Yeah. All my teachers are still there. They're still doing it. This place.
Wow.
St. Paul's Nursery School in downtown Fairfield by the town hall. It's really, really an amazing place. That's really where I started my journey. You know,
they were excited. Look at Brian. Look at how far he's gone.
Yeah, they were bragging about me. It was cool. she was, some of the teachers, they're like, oh, he plays all over the country and all this stuff. And yeah, so I played a few songs last night for a whole bunch of people, and it was really cool. So
that was
my beginning. They were very, very kind to me when I was a wee little lad. And so grew up in the school system there. I went to Fairfield Prep for a couple of years, then went to Fairfield High, graduated. And so music happened for me around, I started off, so my mom was in the church choir, and so she always had kind of a musical side to her, and we had a piano in the house, and I just kind of gravitated towards playing the piano. And I remember getting a keyboard. We got a Juno. We had some kind of a Juno when we got one for Christmas in the mid '80s, and I realized that those things now, the Junos, are like super vintage and super
worth a lot of money.
Yeah, and I wish I still had that. Yeah, I mean, people are playing them now. I see. you know, online and stuff. And I'm like, oh man, I wish I still had that thing. Cause that's where I learned, like Walk of Life and Jump and, you know, Van Halen, all that stuff on that keyboard.
That was church piano for me. I played Star Wars and Jump.
Oh, nice. Good combo. Yeah, for sure. It sounded real good on the Juno though. I mean, all the effects like 1984, you know, all the, completely. I had all that down. And so as like a super, super shy, super introverted kid way back then, that music was really like the way I could connect with people. Yeah. Like if I could play 84 and Jump, you know, for people, they were like, whoa. I mean, that blew.
You just get on people's island that way.
It blew people away. Yeah. So I was like, wow, this is going to be my thing.
So I was going to ask, that was my next question. Mm-hmm. So music, that was about the time you started playing music when you were in the wee little lad school.
Yeah. Well, not that long. I mean, that was 4 or 5 years old. So, but probably by the time I was 12, maybe,
you know, that's when you knew that you wanted to play music.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, that's when 12. I knew it was a thing to do and a thing that I can do, you know.
Is there any specific artist that was like you could point to and you could say, oh, I get it. I could do that too.
Yeah. After a while, it was just kind of a little bit of kind of generic, like what was on the radio, like, you know, Dire Straits. Like I just referenced Dire Straits and stuff like that and Van Halen. It was just on the radio. So it seemed really kind of distant, but something I could relate to and emulate. Like I heard it and I was like, okay, I could figure that out. And I did. But it really wasn't till I mellowed out a little bit more into the folky stuff that Neil Young came into my world. And I was like, I really felt a connection with him. I'm like, that guy's voice and the things that he's singing about, I really, I was like, this guy's an alien and I relate to that, you know?
When did you realize you were into
I guess that was probably early high school.
That was
much later than the, I mean, that was like early 90s and stuff like that. Yeah. To when I first really thought that, you know, I can write, I want to write songs like that, you know, not just cop the Van Halen stuff, but like that I could, that's kind of around the time where I got my first acoustic guitar too, 14, 15. Uh-huh. That just the resonance of the acoustic just really went right to my soul, So I kind of started with the more electric, like keyboard, and then playing electric guitar to, you know, figuring out all like the Randy Rhoads stuff. I used to have I had the Ozzy tribute song, but the tab book, you know, and that would be like, that was just homework enough for a lifetime. I'm like, I got the old
tablature books.
I just locked myself in my room and just learned all that stuff. And then the acoustic guitar came along, and then I just really felt like, okay, now I should really write. I want to write songs. You know?
Do you think like early, I know you mentioned really kind of identifying as wanting to be a musician or realizing that music was going to be your thing in the early 90s. Do you think, and discovering Neil Young, especially.
Yeah.
Do you think that because of preface my point here. I always talk to people about the 90s since we lived through it. And I always say that the floodgates opened in the 90s. Like all of a sudden everything was cool. It was hip hop and metal and dance music and just very experimental period of time. And I think a lot of people, especially young, impressionable teenagers, you know, they start to get into different music that they might not have listened to in their really, really younger years. So do you think, with all that said, do you think the 90s played a part in you discovering Neil Young?
It did, because the way I see it in high school for me in the 90s was like classic rock. Part two. It was like you know, all that music came out in the 60s and 70s. But I think in the 90s for me, whether it was listening to WPLR or whatever, just like that classic rock kind of came around again. And then I just really related to it. And I had immediately wished that I grew up like when that first, you know, when it was all happening in 68, 69, 70, whatever, mid 70s. So I feel like we were fortunate enough to have that come around again and be super popular, I suppose. And then that was kind of my gateway into the kind of music that I wanted to play. Like I really related to that on a soul level.
And you said your mother played?
Yeah, she played a little piano and sang. But
did you have a musical home?
Yeah, in a way. She played a little piano. We had one, like I said. But it was also, like I've written in my bios a million times, it was my dad's Beatles collection, all his records. Like Beatles and Beach Boys were his.
Oh, okay.
His groups. So I looked through all his tapes and records, and he would play Sgt. Pepper's and everything, and on our home stereo. And so I really kind of soaked that in.
Yeah.
And then the big thing in my life, which is part of my story, is that he passed away when I was 15. He died in a car accident, and that was right at the time when I got my acoustic guitar.
Right.
So I immediately linked his passing with my musical ability and ambition to write songs. So that was my way of...
And his record collection.
And his record collection. Yeah, that was my way of trying to keep a connection with him and try to get to the place where he was. I mean, it sounds very metaphysical, but that's kind of the way I think.
No, that's cool.
You know, I'm going to write these songs and try to reach where he is, you know, and stay connected with him somehow.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm very lucky. My father's still alive, but I had that same kind of experience. For me, it was my dad. It was Elvis Presley, and Kenny Rogers, and Johnny Cash. And
nice.
That was the record stuff that my dad shared with me when I was younger, when I was really impressionable. That and Big D-103.
Yeah. Oh, right.
You remember the radio station?
Yeah.
Big D-103 was always. But you're a solo artist now.
Mm-hmm.
Have you always wanted to be a solo artist? Did you have bands before, or did you just kind of go out on your own?
Yeah, high school I played with my friends, and we did, I guess this was probably sophomore year, junior in high school, maybe. There was a place in Fairfield called The Beanery, and it was kind of, it was like a teen nightclub. It was down on South Pine Creek Road, and it's where the par 3 golf course is. I don't know if you happen to know that, or anybody.
Vaguely remember. But
it was like before that was a tennis club or whatever. It was also had this teen nightclub thing, and we played a few gigs there, and we played for all these people. You know, it's like when you're that age, like kids just congregate and just have like a built-in audience.
Do.
I know
.
Exactly. So we played some pretty big gigs then, and we're all covers. We played like Bad Company and Tom Petty and like all that kind of stuff. And that was a lot of fun. And we did that for a bunch of years. But I had always had that solo artist thing for me. Yeah. I felt like I had such a personal artistic vision to try to craft and create and put out that I wasn't going to be in like a democratic thing. You know, I just
it's a wise decision, man. I've been in some democracies that just destroys bands.
Yeah,
it does.
Yeah, and
not all the time.
Not all the time. And but you think of a lot of the great bands, and they're not necessarily democratic.
No,
you know?
No. Well, I mean, there's always like that one or two people in it, and that makes sense. I'm reflecting back right now on a Facebook post you had a couple of days ago about Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah,
you're jogging. And I was more into Motley Crue, and that kind of dictates my band kind of thing, because I had bands for a long time. But knowing that you listened to Ozzy and making that connection as a solo artist, I bet like that played a part. Like I could see where that you could identify with that.
Yeah,
like Ozzy was a solo guy. I'm going to be a solo.
Yeah. They know that's a good that's a good point. I mean, I love I listen to all Crue and all that stuff too as well. But it happened. I did gravitate towards, the one artist who had their name on their records, whatever.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of that metal stuff came from wanting to learn the guitar parts though too. Like that going back to that music is like. For me, it's almost guitar centered as well.
Randy Rhoads, man.
Yeah, I loved Randy and all those,
and Eddie.
Yeah,
obviously those two guys.
Absolutely,
they changed the nature of rock guitar in the '80s, late '70s, early '80s.
Yeah, so I kind of wanted to do that too.
Did you? You were into a little bit heavier stuff.
Yeah, started off heavy.
What did you get into? Like, give me a timeline of what you're into to where you are now, what really lights your fire now.
Yeah. There was a very strong transition between the heavier stuff, listening to, like, Iron Maiden and one and my best friend. Yeah, best friends, you know, whatever. We used to just have, I had all those records, man, and the artwork was just,
oh yeah.
There's something about, yeah, metal and teenagers, they just go together, you know? It was just, you're just fascinated by like all the stories that
mythological.
Yeah. And I love that too. Like yeah. A lot of the Maiden songs are just crazy,
based
crazy
on novels.
Stories. Yeah.
Based on novels.
Right, mostly. Which I didn't know at the time. Yeah. It just seemed like, where is this coming from? You know, so I loved all that. And then in the kind of middle, late high school, different things you're into and into taking and all stuff like that. You just kind of mellowed me out a little bit. And then all of a sudden, one time, I'll never forget, I was at a party and Grateful Dead live from Radio City. I forget what the video is, but it was their acoustic concerts mm-hmm. in Radio City, 1980. And the song, what's it called? It must have been The Roses, I think, was on, or To Lay Me Down. One of the really, really mellow Grateful Dead songs and mm-hmm. Played acoustic. And it was just super late at night. And the video was on. And I was the only one standing in the room. Everyone, I think the rest of the party was somewhere else. And I was just transfixed. I'm like, this is the most beautiful music I've ever heard.
Oh, wow.
Super mellow, super, I mean, again, the words and the melodies and everything, it's just, that really turned me on to the Dead then. So then Grateful Dead was my doorway to a lot of other more folky stuff. And mm-hmm. then again, getting heavy into Neil and it led me to some bluegrass later in college and stuff like that. I was really into bluegrass. I remember writing a paper in college in Colorado, I think. And I think I still have it. It was titled How Bluegrass Music Will Change the World. And I wrote a paper on that. I don't know what I said, but that was the title. And so I was really just on a mission, I guess, of some sort to try to write and play music that's going to change the world and change my world too. I really wanted to change my world and my history and all the, you know, stuff that I went through. I wanted to make it into something beautiful and not just tragic.
That's a goal. That's that is a profound thing with music. I know, or at least it seems like some people are just in it for the attention or mm-hmm. no one's in it for the money because yeah. there is no money.
Yeah.
But for the attention or something to do or to pass the time, but I think most serious artists are not out for the party. They're actually mm-hmm. there to say something.
Yeah.
And you have a lot to say in your music.
Mm.
Let's talk about your new record.
Cool.
Horse.
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
I get from it that it's a very transient kind of record in terms of it talks about your travels
mm-hmm.
and not necessarily yours. I don't know if they're all personal, but there seems like
really,
a lot of
yeah.
moving, a lot of locations, travel, nomadic mm-hmm. kind of you are the troubadour.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that record for a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. I consciously, with this one, I consciously got a little bit away from the super personal diary songwriting, which I did on last couple records. If I Don't Speak a Word and A Place That I Can Feel. We're more personal.
Yeah.
And I just kind of wanted to expand my songwriting to different stories, you mm-hmm. know, and just kind of more, I was thinking a little bit more country, a little bit more, I kind of had John Prine in my mind a little bit. And then just, you know, like some of the stories
yeah.
that are obviously not autobiographical for him, but they paint a picture and
right.
you know they're character driven, I guess I could say that. So I wanted to I was thinking of these characters and a lot of yeah nomadic Western Southern stories, and there's still a lot of me in the record. It's just sometimes you just kind of subvert it into a story, you know, and a character that you can relate with.
Yeah, I think what I get the element of you in it is, and I think we can tie this into this question here. But the element of you that I get in this record with your songs are the traveler.
Mm-hmm.
You are,
yeah.
In my own words, and I've told you this a million times, but I'll say it in front of everybody here. You are criminally underrated troubadour songwriter from Connecticut. I don't think gets enough attention. I feel like people should be like, holy shit, that's Brian Dolzani. Like, because you
I appreciate that, man.
You work really hard.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
yeah.
the bottom line. I don't know if you have any opinions on any of that, but feel free to respond.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm also, obsessively restless.
You are.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I need to go out and see the world. It's not, it's like, all right, where can I travel next? As opposed to, and this may hurt the career stuff. 'Cause it's not like, all right, where can I play for the most people? It's like, where do I want to see next? Mm-hmm. You know? So, and then I'm hoping that the fans and everything else will fall into place.
Well, do you find
at the same time?
I haven't been traveling as much the past couple of years because mm-hmm. my wife and I had a baby, but I'm getting ready to start going back out again.
Yeah.
And, but do you find, or at least I find, I should say, that being an independent musician, especially a solo guy, mm-hmm. you're almost like a politician going out and trying to talk to as many people as possible and sell them on your message.
Yeah.
Not that you're trying to sell them.
No, I know. That's
you're trying to sell yourself and your artwork.
Yeah.
That
totally resonates. It's funny because a few months ago, I had that same exact thought. I'm like, especially well now that it's almost like campaign season, I'm like, yeah. I have to like run out and, you know, do a freaking campaign. You know, like I have to do a campaign. Yeah. Like, what are those people doing? Like going out to every, you know, county in Iowa and, you know, like shaking everybody's hand in a diner. I'm like, oh my God, like, do I have to be that extroverted? Like kind of.
Do I have to go to the hog races?
Yeah, exactly. But it is, it is like that. I mean, whether you're in a band or a solo artist, I guess it's the same thing. You just, but it is all on me, you know?
And it's strange too, because I don't know how you approach it, but like sometimes it's not that I don't want to talk to people. I just don't want to talk because I'm using my voice.
Yeah.
Lack of sleep.
Right.
You know, living on the road is a completely different lifestyle.
Yeah,
and, you
it's
know, you're
not
really
easy.
pushing
not
your boundaries. So
not at all.
Like you really it's just a mechanical thing. You don't want to use your voice.
Yeah.
But you have to talk to people, especially when you're out on the road. Which
for
is
sure.
The ironic part in it.
I do that at the gigs and stuff. I mean, it's a little different than a campaign, I suppose, where you don't walk into a diner at 11 o'clock in the morning and say, hey, I'd like to tell you about my music.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of weird. Like you kind of wait for the gig. Like the gig is the thing,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You just try to get people out and, you know, social media and stuff like that. But, I am trying to, reach out a lot more than I do for just all the stuff that leads up to the show. There's so much that you can do and so much
you can never do.
Yeah.
Enough.
You can never do enough. Yeah. And you almost, in my case, like you almost don't know exactly, well, what should I be doing, you know, today at 2 o'clock and I'm playing tonight and like I'm sitting in the town, like what else can I do?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, there's some people that'll be like playing on the green or something like that, like busking or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I respect that, but I'll be like, man, I don't want to blow my voice out for tonight.
True.
I can't do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Because I need to be really, really good tonight.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree.
So traveling so much, I notice you've been traveling a lot more down south, like mm-hmm. Tennessee, Carolinas, Georgia, and all that stuff. How do you feel about comparing audiences in the north to the south? I'm going to get all Civil War here.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but, I mean, do you see the difference?
No.
And there's a story I have to plug in behind this.
Okay,
too,
okay. I do find in general that people in the south do like my style of music more than up here, a little bit more. It's just, I don't know. I mean, I just feel like I have a Southern soul in a way, and mm-hmm. that doesn't mean I can't play anywhere else, I mean,
right.
obviously. But also to me, it's just kind of where I've been focusing a lot. I mean, I actually need to focus more up here in the Northeast, mm-hmm. more than I do even. It's just a matter of how many times I've been down there and the places that I play over and over again. It's just kind of I've made it a habit.
Yeah.
But I do find that there is a little bit of a more slowness and relaxed vibe down there that mm-hmm. seems to be open to the more like folky songwriters stuff. So
right.
just seems to fit.
I was in South Carolina, I think, one time.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I was at a bar playing mm-hmm. and before I went on, I was, you know, going through my phone, I see a Facebook post from our friend Daphne,
uh-huh.
and her question was, you know, what is the deal with people from Connecticut moving to Nashville or moving out of Connecticut into mm-hmm. somewhere else? And, you know, relating to the music thing. And I just kind of made a very observational reply to that, in that my feeling is that music seems to be more of a culturally involved thing in some southern areas mm-hmm. versus up in the north. It's yeah. not, I feel like, well, not even the focus, but I think it's more of like the cultural aspect. We're not, music isn't part of the culture so much
yeah.
in northern states as it is, at least that's been my experience.
Yeah.
I mean, especially in a town like Nashville,
yeah.
which shouldn't even be a comparison, but even other right. places.
Yeah, I agree.
You picked that up.
Totally. I think the whole idea of playing on the porch and where the blues began in the South and all that stuff, it's just, yeah. that's just what people do, you know. Daddy played guitar, mommy sang bass, or what, you know, like just all that kind of stuff.
I sang in the church on
yeah,
Sunday.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I think it's, I mean, way up here and like as an extension of New York City and everything, it's just things are faster paced and more impatient and people want to see results right away. And it's not about the long journey of playing music and dipping into the rich history that yeah. music has to offer, it not as opposed to like the bottom line, like you're saying, or how much money are you making, or you know,
yeah, there's no that. There's literally like, this is the birthplace of Elvis Presley mm-hmm. here in oh my god, I'm blanking out of the name,
in Tupelo
yeah. thank you
yeah
there is no
yeah
up here
yeah
I unless know. You're talking about Trey Anastasio or something,
right? Yeah, yeah.
Is he born
Vermont? yeah, for sure.
But yeah, it just doesn't seem.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Tying into that, I hear a lot of people complain that there's no good music on the radio. The radio sucks,
mm-hmm.
and the radio does suck
mm-hmm.
for the most part. I mean, it's yeah. all pre-programmed.
Yeah.
No DJs. Nobody's doing deep cuts unless you're going on a really lower on the dial FM radio show at,
yeah.
at like 11 p.m. on a Sunday night.
Right. And there are some of those out there. Yeah.
What do you say when people say that? I think there's a lot of good music.
Yeah, it's not on the radio anymore.
Right.
You definitely have to, yeah, you got to seek it out. I mean, it's all there. And I guess it's just a matter of paying attention to what your friends are listening to, and we're passing like video links back and forth. It's all mm-hmm. it's all on social media now, you know,
or Spotify.
That
kind of plays a big part in things.
Yeah, it sure does. Especially where the music is, I mean, I think the music now is your business card that you hand out,
right?
You know, especially Spotify, where it's all free, you know,
basically.
So it's the stuff on the radio used to be free. I mean, it was free to listen to, you know, but it was one song that was heavily promoted by radio promoters and payola and all that stuff. And now it's all on spot. It's all there for you to discover. You just have to find a way to it, you know, and if it's good enough, it should call to your attention, you know?
And I feel like there is a certain aspect of Spotify and Apple Music and Pandora and all that stuff where it does equate, in a sense, to the 50s and 60s and 70s radio of yesteryear.
Mm-hmm.
People do pay to have their songs played on these formats.
Right.
People do pay people to push their songs.
Yeah.
Just like there was the illegal payola back
yeah.
in the radio.
Yeah.
Back in those days.
Yeah.
So it's still kind of as easy as it is to be an independent artist and get your music quote unquote out there.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a lot of competition.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes like I think what you're about to say is money makes a difference. Like you do.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, all the artists that I feel and that are comparable to us and that are on whatever that next level is, of whether they just got signed to a great indie label or whatever, or they're being promoted by Rolling Stone or whatever. There was a radio promoter and a press person who made that happen.
Oh yeah. You
know, and that is expensive, because I've looked into that and,
oh,
and
yeah.
all that stuff.
Well, that's the thing.
And so, yeah, it's not, that's not free.
No.
Yeah. You know, it doesn't just happen either.
Do you use people? I mean, like, do you have a booking agent?
A little, yeah. Someone who does certain tours for me. It's getting a little, I'm doing back to doing a little bit more myself, just because I still have a ton of contacts and I could do a lot myself,
yeah.
You know. But I haven't found that perfect agent that's going to book me all year long, you know.
Yeah.
And I've done a couple. I've done a couple radio campaigns in the past, and again, you find a lot of people that aren't right, and they're just there to kind of take your money, and nothing happens from it. So it's really it's a huge gamble.
It's weird. You really have to kind of, in today's day and age, you really have to be taking the ball by yourself and running as far as you can with
it. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the more clout you have, or the more, you know, numbers you can talk about, or whatever, or connections you have, that someone will be able to, you know, do something with that, as opposed to taking you from zero to 100. Like, that doesn't really happen.
For all you youngins out there that are trying to start a band, do everything yourself for as long as you can.
Yeah, yeah.
But
and be super impressive at what you're doing.
That's just a side note.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back to the horse record real quick. What was the... You talked about how it was a less personal story record.
Yeah.
What was the catalyst for that? Why did you take that direction? Why did you want to do more storytelling that was more accessible, where it could have been anybody? I guess the accessibility is more.
Well, that's the interesting thing. I don't think...
Like, it was a conscious decision?
The way I wrote these songs, I think there's still a ton of detail, and I don't think anybody could have written them. I feel like I hope it's still me who made up these details and like these stories. But I guess I started to feel a little self-conscious and feel like I was just putting too many diary entries, like too personal in a way, in my own details. I guess it was an attempt to reach out to the world a little bit more and say, hey, this isn't just me.
Was there one song that, or maybe two songs that kind of kicked that off for you?
Yeah, I guess it was. I mean, I think the first song I wrote for Horse was Horse itself.
Uh-huh.
And I had an open tuning and capo on the second, and I was just walking around my house, and the first line came to me. I know my horse is blinded, but he knows the way.
Yeah.
And so it felt like that wasn't necessarily me, but it was going to be a story about some cowboy in the 1800s, whatever. I'm like, all right, I just feel like going there, you know, because it's something that I'm interested in. I love those kind of stories, kind of from another time,
right,
in a way. And I just kind of felt like going there.
They are, you know? It is a good collection of timeless songs.
Mm.
I shouldn't say good. It's an excellent.
I appreciate that.
No, it's a great collection of kind of timeless, nomadic kind
of themed
songs. And it really could have been some of them. You could have been in the 1880s. You could have been in the 1980s.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like that.
Yeah, that was really, the experiment with it, for sure.
You do a better job with it than me. I can't write fictional characters to save my life.
Yeah, yeah. It was new. I mean, yeah, it was a totally new thing for me, but I wanted to try it and see where it went.
And you recorded that at the fantastic Dirt Floor Studios with Mr. Eric Lichter and Steve Whitest. Was he
absolutely
was he
doing a lot Steve of the was there? For you? Yeah, for sure.
How was that experience for you?
It was fantastic. It was great.
Seems from the side, it was a match made in heaven.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, me and Eric are very similar souls and have a lot of the same influences and kind of reading each other's mind, you know, as we're going along. And we both just picked up instruments, and it just kind of all fell together very, very easily. Yeah.
Did you have
naturally?
Did you have arrangement decisions before you walked in, or did you just
kind of walk in? No, we really took
voice
one.
And
yeah,
guitar.
We took one song at a time. I was kind of bringing a new, like a couple songs to each session, saying, "All right, should we do this one or that one?" And it would be based off the last one we recorded. So okay, like now that we did Horse, like where do we want to go from here? Like all right, let's do this kind of song. And it was one at a time. So that was something new for this record, is I didn't have a track list beforehand. Where the past couple albums, because I did in Nashville and I only had a short amount of time, like I wanted to be as prepared as I could as far as like,
right,
you know, here's the 10, 12 songs or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I knew what I was going to, at least I knew what the songs were going to be when I got down there and recorded them for a week or two. This one was just really one at a time. So I had no idea what the end package was going to be.
And you had bands on the previous record.
Yeah, yeah.
This was literally just you and Eric, right?
Yeah, we didn't.
On horse.
Yeah, we didn't have anybody else. So it was pretty wild.
Eric plays
everything. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a very full sounding record, and that's thanks to Eric playing a ton of instruments amazingly well.
Oh yeah. So, oh, he's got a great vision too.
Yeah.
He's a great person to work with. I haven't worked with him on my own stuff, but doing stuff with Jeff Burnham.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, you were there.
Yeah. It was really cool.
Absolutely.
In the cabin rules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The mountaintop cabin.
I mean, that's actually the perfect atmosphere for this record. I mean, I can't imagine it being as warm and storytelling as it is if it was recorded, you know, someplace with four cement walls.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think it would have the same vibe.
That's a very good point. Absolutely. It was perfectly, you know, the perfect spot for it.
So one of my favorite topics, and you don't really get into it as much as I do, and I've actually been trying to keep myself out of it, but politics.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about, I'm not going to ask you if you're conservative or progressive or anything like that, but how do you feel about what you do?
I'm sure you can guess.
I know.
Yeah, that's okay.
But how do you feel about what you do? Well, I'm going to back this up. I'm going to preface this question too.
Okay.
I feel, or at least I've been feeling the past 5 or 6 years, probably even longer, and this probably even goes back into like my metal rebellious days, is that music should have a message and be an observer and storyteller of the times.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of my problem with this is I'm also an art student, and I was taught and educated that art told a story and responded to the events of the times.
Yeah.
You know, whether it was commissioned paintings to tell stories of religious, you know, texts or et cetera. And one of my favorite periods of music is the 60s, you know, protest rock.
Yeah.
You know, but the storytelling reflecting the times. How do you feel about what you do in this climate? Do you feel an obligation to tell stories about this particular political climate we're in? Or do you feel like, I'm sure people get enough of that crap on a daily basis, so I want to pull them away from it and bring them somewhere else. They can forget about it for an hour or two.
Right. That's a good question. I would only write, I've written a couple. There's a song from a couple of years ago, When God Asks You Why, is probably my most like obvious song about the story, like events of the day, all the like shootings and violence and all this stuff. And so that was, it can't be forced for me. I don't necessarily want to just talk about like what's in the newspaper. Yeah, I'm dating myself. The newspaper, you know, what's in the news?
No, all the millennials are doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
Newspapers.
Yeah, go out and buy a paper. I don't necessarily want it to be forced. And like you said, I don't necessarily want to just rehash everything that everyone like that are just headlines, because I do feel like we're inundated. Mm-hmm. And I at the same time, I'm just gonna talk this out and think it through as I'm talking.
Sure.
I don't necessarily want to avoid that, and I don't want to go in like, all right, this is going to be like an hour of fantasy and let's pretend all that stuff isn't happening. Like, that's not really my style either.
That's disingenuous.
I want to be in the world and yet try to make something beautiful out of it and have kind of my own statement about it, as opposed to just like, here's the news. So I did write to a new song called Culture of Fighting, which I posted just the demo on my Facebook page.
Got
a lot of response to it. So I did record that a couple last month in Memphis when I was out there. And that felt like it was kind of my comments on the time, but also trying to get a perspective that's beyond everything that's going on. Like, we have part of the lyrics, we have the left, we have the right. Like, let's just try to find a third thing. And that kind of gets back to like the triangle and like a very, again, metaphysical concept of three things. Like, when you have two things at war with each other, it's just binary, and that you're not going to get to a new place unless you have a third point. And that makes like the sacred triangle. And there's like the law of three, which is a very metaphysical thing that's in the, like a concept that's in the universe. There's the law of three and the law of seven. And they both have, you know, this goes back to like Plato and the stars and everything. Like it goes way back. So to me, like the idea of a third thing will help you get out of the battle of the two.
Mm-hmm.
So for that song, I tried to find, you know, find my way to that third thing. And so I'll comment on society and stuff like that when I feel like I have something new to say about mm-hmm. it. So, and that can't be forced. And if it happens, it happens. So every once in a while, it'll happen. That's a long answer to your story. Like, I'm not like, all right, I'm going to write a political song right now, you know. But for this one, I wanted to record it right away, and I hope to get it out this summer because it felt kind of like Ohio in a way.
Where oh, yeah.
It's like this stuff happened, and he wrote a song, and it was out on the radio the next week. You know, right. I kind of felt like that with this song. So I'm hoping it's going to be out in the next month or so. But it's rare for me. Yeah, I don't want to go up and just, you know, rehash everything that everybody's like inundated with, you know.
Do you feel a little nervous about doing stuff like that, like putting
a little bit because it is different.
Such a strong statement?
Yeah, because it's very different than the normal songs that I write, which are a little bit, well, a lot more introspective and a little, you know, maybe you want to marinate with a little bit more and mm-hmm. you know, you put your own perspective in and just try to figure out what the heck I'm talking about, you know, as opposed to being so obvious. Yeah, I don't love to be so obvious, but every once in a while it's okay.
I'm going to just talk about for myself for a second.
Go for it, man.
No, the reason I asked that question about being nervous about putting stuff like that out, mm-hmm. because I mean, I do get nervous. Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit, well, very recently I've been a little bit more of a political writer and mm-hmm. I put a song out a couple years ago called Who's America? And I mm-hmm. actually promoted it to the best, and I like such a strong response to it, but I was so afraid of, like, you know, just one unstable person reacting negatively to it. And but at the same time, I felt it was kind of important to say those things, like maybe if I can help somebody. That's my daughter.
Oh.
Having a fit,
coming through.
If I can help somebody kind of articulate what they might be thinking or what they mm-hmm. might be feeling, and letting them know. And I think this goes about through all music. It's just letting people know that it's okay to feel those things.
Yeah.
Whether it's lost love or heartbreak or you know, being mad at whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah, or anger about what's going on. Absolutely. I think you just have to feel it. And it's a personal thing from artist to artist, mm-hmm. whether you feel comfortable and ready to do that. And, you know, you want to take a stand about an issue, I think you should do it. Absolutely.
And part of those things, too... Or part of those feelings as a writer, as a musician, mm-hmm. like you mentioned Ohio.
Yeah.
I mean, what a great, great song. I mean, my hair is standing up talking about it.
And it lives on today. I mean, I play it every once in a while with the band and everyone's like, hell yeah. You know?
And it's so weird because it's still, the message, even though it took place so long ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, it almost scarily, mm-hmm. eerily.
Yeah.
Resonates to today.
I know. And it's
that's crazy.
It is the crazy thing that you could think about. You hope we've changed a whole lot, but at the same time, we realize we haven't changed enough, you know, for that to still resonate.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, we haven't gotten far enough.
That was really my daughter in the background crying, so we had to go address that. We had to go haul her off. No.
Those aren't post effects right there. <not that. laughs>
My wife is a saint, mm-hmm. and my daughter is an angel, but she's mm-hmm. a little devil sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so amen. Moving on, you have some tour dates coming up. This is the second leg of your spring tour?
Yeah, I guess it just kind of worked out that way, mid-April and now early May, so... Going back to some of my favorite haunts, going down to D.C. and Floyd, Virginia, and South Carolina, and hitting Nashville again. And so it'll be a good 10 days.
Floyd, Virginia, is that the... is it a winery?
It's called the Floyd Country Store.
Floyd Country Store.
Yeah, which is right in the middle of town. I mean, Floyd only has like one street, you know, it's just kind of one strip, main street. There's a cool brewery, couple restaurants, and then the famous Floyd Country Store, which has bluegrass jams all the time, and some super famous people come play there on that stage. And it's a really old, and they have like a I don't know what you call it, barn dancing or some old school, like, yeah, jigs and stuff.
Oh, that's so cool.
I've been there for that. It's such a throwback in a way, but also, I mean, there are a lot of contemporary people go there. And then every Saturday they have what's called Americana Saturdays, and you should really check that out and do that.
Yeah.
Every Saturday from like 12 to 3, they have a bunch of acts that do like an hour set.
Oh, so they have like stuff going on like all day?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's during the day.
Oh,
yeah,
I love that.
And there's probably a show at night too on Saturday nights
too.
But yeah, it's a special thing they do on the weekends during the day.
And Gypsy Sally's in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
You like that place?
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to say, no, I hate it. But
yeah.
But, I mean, it's a cool spot.
Yeah, it is a cool spot. I mean, I think it's been up and down as far as like potential. I think the potential is really cool there. I mean,
it's just hard when there's a loud concert next door.
Yeah,
sometimes
it's got to be the right fit next door.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've had some great fits and I've had some not so good fits.
Yeah.
So you kind of cross your fingers that there's a good fit next door. Cause if it's like more of like a jam band or like roots rock or something, the audiences will mingle and people come over to the lounge and it'll be cool. I mean, seeing Jerry and Neil on the, you know, on the, all those pictures that they have, you know, the artwork,
the great record collection behind
you. Yeah. Yeah. So it has potential and I keep hoping it's going to be good.
Yeah.
So.
No, it's a cool spot.
Yeah.
Is the VW,
the bus is still there.
Still
yeah.
There?
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's a cool thing.
Yeah.
One thing I forgot to talk about was your photography.
Mm, right. Yeah.
Cause I'm so happy to have you here as a musician, but you've become quite the photographer.
Thank you.
Do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And you're more
of
an analog guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I shoot film probably 95%. I mean, I have a digital camera too, but I just – the difficulty and the labor that film requires is just attractive to me, and I just love the tones of it, you
it's
know?
More personal.
Yeah,
I think things that are more hands-on.
Yeah, yeah. It feels more like an art.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to where I'm attracted to things that everyone else don't do all the time. You know, so I'm like, not a lot of people do this, so I'm going to do that. You know,
I fix carburetors.
Yeah,
<I'm just>
exactly. Right. Let's talk about that.
Do you have a studio? Dark room in your house?
No, I don't have a dark room, but I do develop both film or black and white and color at home. I have a changing bag and then put all the chemicals in my sink and
that's
do it.
Right.
So,
you don't have a see when I was
so
in
I don't
college,
yeah I don't print at home, which is what would require the enlarger in the dark room and stuff like that.
When I was in college doing the film developing, we literally went into these little closets. And just that were completely
totally
blocked
dark.
Out.
Yeah, yeah.
And we practiced in the light on the containers.
Yeah,
where we had to like feed it through this plastic thing.
Yep,
spiral reel.
Around. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I have a metal reel that I like. A couple of metal reels, and I had to practice a lot doing that. In the daylight, and then you go in the changing bag, and it's dark. Yeah, or you could black out the room. I just didn't really have a good room for that, and didn't want to take that expense. So like $20 changing bag, and I do it. Pretty much it's like you're blindfolded, but you know, I've gotten pretty good at it. So yeah, I love
it
shooting
is an
film.
Art.
I take my cameras on my travels. I'm like, I'm out in the country. I need to shoot what's out here.
Is that what kind of like started it off? You're just driving through. You're like, I should bring a camera with me from now on.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. You know, a few years ago, I found a guy. I was in Vermont and looked up online and found this guy who was selling a few analog cameras, and I bought one from him, and he really gave me like this, like kind of a film 101 real quick.
Oh, wow.
And gave me a bunch of lenses, and I think he gave me some film too, and filters and all this stuff. Like, he pretty much gave me a kit and told me, you know, what it is and how to use it. And
nice.
It's just developed from there. No pun intended. And I have like a whole basement full of film cameras and lenses and filters and all this stuff, you know,
next to
and
the
I
guitars
actually,
and amps.
Yeah. Yeah. Next to guitars and amps. And I also kind of, started this side business of selling old cameras as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I buy and sell. I've got this another Etsy site called Film Picker Cameras, which I don't promote much on my site. I just kind of let people find me on Etsy. And I sell probably a few cameras a week. And you know, yeah. So I go out and hunting, picking, you know, I pick for like old camera. I try to find cheap old cameras somewhere. And and I test them, fix them up, make sure they work, and then right. I sell them. And I've turned that's been a really fun thing because I turn on a lot of people to film photography, and people write me on Etsy and they're looking through my catalog and they're like, oh yeah, this camera looks great. You know, tell me how to use this, or I'm new to film and I want to get a new camera. And it's really a fun thing because it's still kind of new for me. So I get to like teach it to someone who's just learning it as well. And I'm a couple steps ahead of them, and you know, it's really cool. So that's fun.
I would imagine the Antique stores along the way on your travels.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Goodwills and stuff too. I'm always
Goodwills.
I'm looking at,
there's a really great, the place you play in Putnam, I played there too, the Stomping Ground in Connecticut.
Yeah.
There's two huge antique stores across the street.
Yeah. And it's such a cool little town, and I'm always there like too late at night. You know, every time I go there, I'm like, I want to come here during the day, you know, and walk around and check those places out.
So you haven't been in them?
No, I haven't.
Oh, dude.
Really?
They're so much. They're huge.
Oh man!
They had a couple old Victrolas there, but they were like $700 and $900. Can't.
Yeah, yeah.
As much as I want to.
Yeah, it's a big investment for something that's just going to sit there.
But there's a lot of cool stuff, and I'm almost positive there's cameras.
Yeah,
there.
I'm sure. I'll look next time.
So tour starts May
2nd.
2nd.
Yeah,
May
I actually 2nd. Do have a couple Connecticut dates at the end of that, which I should talk about.
Oh yeah.
So May 14th, back at the Woodbury Brewing Company with Glenn Roth and Matt Hires, great songwriter. I don't know where he's from. He's a touring act, so he's not from here. But I've come across him before, and he knows the con artists who are putting on the show. They're good friends, and he's done shows with them before.
Great.
So that'll be a triple bill on the 14th, and then May 18th, I'm playing at the State House with my band. Yeah.
Have you been there before?
Pat Stone and another band. No, I haven't been there yet.
Oh, it's
I'm
really,
really
cool
looking
room.
Forward to it. I'm so bummed I missed Steve's show there. I was away. I don't know where I was. Yeah, I guess I was on my April tour. Yeah.
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 It's
so
a cool
I really
spot.
Wanna, I'm looking forward to that one.
Cool. So anything else that the audience should know about you?
Let me see. Well, that's a good question.
It's always the worst question.
Yeah,
like,
no,
what,
it's
did
like
I,
well,
what did I not talk about?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I would consider myself a seeker and an adventurer, and just I love nothing more than writing new songs and see where it's going to go, and you know, kind of plotting my next creative journey.
Cool.
You know, so I've been writing a whole bunch of songs the past few months, and I'm actually getting back to the personal, which feels really good.
Hmm.
So after a little journey out, I'm ready to come back again and. Kind of, I feel like a lot of times I'll, and maybe this is a songwriter thing, an artist thing, we kind of go back to the same well a lot of the times because if it's our own personal well, it's deep enough to where you can keep going back to it and trying to find new stuff. And even if you're revisiting similar topics, you find a new way to say it, you know? And that's kind of where I'm at. So I've been building up after the Horse record. I didn't write a song for maybe 9 months, which is really rare for me. Like I used to write all the time, like almost every day or every week I would have a new song. And it felt in a way like I was real angsty to just keep going. Like I had like every song I wrote, I felt like I could do better and I wanted to do something more. So I finally calmed down a little bit where I was really happy with these Horse songs. And I'm like, I'm just going to play them. I'm just going to stick to them. So the audience isn't getting confused because I'm playing new songs every day. You know, like I'm going to stick with this similar set list and here's the songs. And then now I'm finally back, and which was a good kind of a rest period. And now I'm really ready to get back and put out a whole another slew of creativity.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you think you know where you're going to do it?
No, I'm not.
Play
not,
by ear.
Yeah, I'm not quite ready to
make that decision.
To make that decision. Yeah. Right now, it's still the songs. So it's not an album yet in any means. I don't need to rush out and
can always do a Nebraska style.
Yeah, yeah.
I would love
about
to do something
too,
like that
for sure.
That's one of my favorite Springsteen records.
Absolutely.
Ugh,
absolutely.
So good.
Yeah.
Well, awesome.
Perfect.
Brian cool Dolzani, man. Everybody. BrianDolzani.com.
Yes.
Correct?
Yeah.
BrianDolzani.com. And he's going to be starting his tour, Spring Tour Part 2, mm-hmm. May 2nd. Thank you for coming. Thank you for being on the show.
Friend. Yeah.
Right hope on. You had a good time.
Mad
have
respect
a great,
for you, man. Absolutely.
Have a great spring tour. Oh, thanks.
Thanks, man.
Thanks. And
congratulations on this. This thanks. Is very cool.
It's fun. We'll yeah. see you again.
Right on.
Ciao. Okay, there you have it. That's Brian Dolzani, singer-songwriter troubadour from Fairfield, Connecticut. You can check him out online at briandolzani.com. He's going to be starting the second leg of his spring tour on May 2nd in Washington, D.C. at Gypsy Sally's. He's also got a couple Connecticut dates coming up. May 14th, Woodbury Brewing Company with Glenn Roth and Matt Hires, and May 18th at the State House with Pat Stone and others. Those last two dates there, they're not listed on his website, so just wanted to make sure y'all knew about them. And thank you for listening once again. The show's been a lot of fun. I hope everybody's enjoying it, getting a lot of good feedback. If you have any questions, just give me a shout out. You can visit me online at sethadam.com, or you can go straight to the podcast page at sethadampodcast.com. Spread the word, spread the love. Have a great day. Peace.
You can tell who the real ones are. They won't let you down. You can tell.